You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
Ho, 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 ho. Why does he say that anyway? Ho, 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 like you got nothing better to do? That's a really bad, poor vocabulary. Well, hey guys, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, very good, excellent. Well, I need your help because you know this song, and so you're going to sing along with me, all right? Cue the music and the feedback.
You better watch out. You better not cry.
Sing it.
I'll tell you why. Santa Claus is coming to town.
Louder! Let him hear it online.
He's making a list and
checking it twice.
He's going to find out who's naughty or nice. Santa Claus is coming to town.
Very good. Keep going.
He sees you as you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you devour good soul.
So good for goodness sake.
Oh, you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town.
Well done. Thank you. Thank you for humoring me. Sorry, I don't know if any of you younger kids, you know, like Myra, I'm not really Santa Claus. I'm just Sean dressed up, so I hope I didn't ruin it for you. And I don't know who last wore this, but there's some funk going on right in here. It is smelling pretty bad. But of course, you know, it is February, the first Sunday in February, so we are almost at Christmas. I'm pretty sure next week Walmart will switch over because Valentine's Day decorations are way gone. I think right now they're on to Halloween, and then next week they'll be moving on to Christmas to get ready. But at Christmas time, you know, there's this whole thing about Santa Claus. And actually, I'm not going to ruin anybody's life or anything like that, but Santa, St. Nicholas, was a real person who actually cared for kids and did some really cool stuff. And you can read this true story of St. Nick if you want to look that up about him. But at that song, we sing, and there's this line, right, that you're pretty familiar with. And that is that, you know, kind of this concept, and it's a great parental thing. Parents love this line because basically you better watch out. Better watch out because Santa is keeping a list. He has got a list of whether you're what? Or, right, your list of naughty or nice. And you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why, because Santa Claus is coming to town. And he's keeping that list. He's making a list. He's checking it twice to make sure whether you're naughty or nice. And that whole concept, of course, is what you know, we used for kids when they were little and you know, got them to be good for a little bit. And we use that list of an idea of saying, okay, this is why you need to be good. This is why you should be good, because, you know, Santa, you don't want to get coal in your stocking. You want to get the good stuff. And if you're bad, you know, that's going to be the coal thing. Like, that's it. You're not going to get the toy that you wanted. You're not going to get the doll that you wanted, whatever it is, because you were naughty. And because you were naughty, Santa's got that list of the naughtiness. And he's like, no, sorry. Sorry, that's it. It's coal in your stocking for you. And outside of central Pennsylvania, or at least in Pennsylvania, people are like, coal, that sounds great, man. That'll help with my heating bill. It's expensive. But, you know, where I was growing up, coal, like, we didn't know it was a real thing because I was in Delaware as a city and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, but the whole idea of this list that Santa is keeping, and this idea that if you mess up, it's on the list. And if it's on the list, you're going to miss out. You're not going to get something. You're not going to get something you've earned or deserved or feel like you've earned or deserved because you were naughty. And I think that weird mythology that we get from, you know, the years and years of commercialization and Bing Crosby, and actually that was Fred Astaire, have turned that concept about this mythical real creature person, has that idea has moved into our view of God. and the way we look at God and our relationship with Him. And there's this idea that, you know what, if I mess up, God's got a list. And He's got that list of naughty or nice. And as soon as I mess up, He is writing that down and He's keeping track. And He's not just keeping track, He's checking it twice. And if I mess up, then that's it. Then I'm done. And depending on how we look at that, maybe that's, oh, I messed up too bad, so there's no way I could make it into heaven. Or I've messed up, so God could never use me. Or I messed up, and so that means nothing is going to work out the way I want it to. Or whatever it looks like. And we have this idea that God is keeping this list. And it's this list of our naughtiness. And anytime we messed up, anytime we fail, it's going to keep us from getting what we, maybe not what we deserve, but what we hope for. And ultimately maybe keeping us from making our way to eternity with Jesus. But anyway, this idea that that's what God does. He's got this list. And if we mess up, we're on the list. And it's going to keep us from getting what we want or what we need. Last week, we talked about this idea. We'll come to Jacob in a second. We talked about this idea about the redemption of barcodes. And how when I was growing up, you could take barcodes. And if you collected enough of them, you could mail them in and get a prize. This prize. And a lot of times we looked at that. We looked last week how sometimes we take that in our view of God. That we, if we do enough good things, we will earn God's love. And of course, some of those prizes, you didn't need to trade in the barcodes because the prize was already in the box. We already have it. And so that's where we ended last week, talking about we don't need to earn God's love because we have God's love completely and totally. There's nothing we can do to make God love us more. There's nothing you can do to make God love you more. You can't be gooder, better, nicer, sweeter, kinder, gooder-er, because God loves you completely and totally as you are right now. So there's no point in saving the barcodes because the prize is already in the box. And again, we ended last week with, there is nothing you can do to make God love you more. And today I want to talk about the opposite side of that coin. And that is that there is nothing that you can do to make God love you less. Because often we look at this list of naughty and nice and we think, okay, I messed up. I did this thing. I crossed that line. I've got this habit. There's this pattern. Even though I don't want to do it, I'm doing this thing. So our failures aren't obstacles for God's grace. That's what we're talking about this morning. It'll all come back together if you remember anything about what we were just talking about before, but this naughty and nice list. But we're doing this series on the life of Jacob. And the very first week of the series, we started with how God is not bound by culture and how God made this promise to Jacob and Esau, who's his twin brother, to their mom and said, look, your younger son is going to serve the older one. And that was against culture because the oldest was always the one that was in charge. Sorry, the older son will serve the younger. And that was against culture because the oldest was always in charge. And then we looked at the idea how Jacob, then as they got older, he was able to trade a bowl of stew for the birthright, which was the rights of the firstborn, an inheritance. There was a lot more to that. And again, you can find all that at mc3church.org/the-deceiver. Then we went to, from Jacob kind of tricking his brother over this bowl of stew, then we went to Jacob deceiving, intentionally lying to and deceiving Esau and his dad Isaac to steal the blessing, which is basically kind of God's favor and the promise. And so we looked at that, and then last week, we got to this point where Esau, the twin brother, the older twin brother, was so angry at his younger twin brother, Jacob, for stealing his blessing, for tricking him out of the birthright, that he wanted to kill him. And so mom Rebecca goes to dad Isaac and makes up this story about how, you know, maybe we need to send Jacob back to our family to get a wife from our own people so he doesn't intermarry with the other religious people around here and get caught up in their idol worship and all that. And Isaac agrees. Meanwhile, on the outside, Esau sees the story. And again, we talked about this last week. Esau sees this story and he thinks that the reason Jacob is going away is because he was showing his dad how much he loves him. And so Esau tries to jump in and says, I'm going to prove to dad how much I love him, to earn my dad's love. And of course, he ends up marrying a woman in addition to his other two wives. And this woman was from the line of Ishmael, which wasn't the chosen line through Abraham. And it caused all sorts of problems. And that's where we were last week. And so now we're picking up with Jacob. He is now leaving and heading out on this journey back to his homeland of Haran, his hometown of Haran, where his grandfather is from. And he's going there to find a wife. And so that's what we're going to pick up on the story here when we look at this idea of he sees you when you're sleeping. And And so Jacob, first of all, and we're going to be in Genesis chapter 28. In Genesis chapter 28, if you have the YouVersion app, just go to right there at the top to Genesis and swipe down to 28. If you have a paper Bible, we're going to turn on the house lights here, and you can go to Genesis 28. And we're starting out here with Jacob's dream. Jacob's dream, because he starts out with a dream. And that's where we're going to pick up. And all of this should all come back together if we can. I guess the mic was the issue, so that's good. So beginning in verse 10, it says this: Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. Beersheba was where his family was from. That's where he was born. That's where he grew up. That's where he lived with Esau and his mom and dad, Isaac and Rebecca. And it says he set out for Haran because that's where his family is from. He's heading there. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. So it's time to go to sleep. You know, to take a break on his journey. By the way, it was given that he probably traveled for a day or two to get to this point. And he's probably going to be traveling for about a month to get to Haran. It's that far away from where he started out. And he stopped for the night, the sun had set. So taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. So, you know, a long day's journey. Jacob takes a moment to take a nap or to spend the night and sleep there. And he had a dream while he's asleep. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth, with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And you might have heard the term Jacob's ladder, which of course is that really cool little toy that, you know, that does the thing with wood. If you don't know what that is, it's a thing. Look it up. Or you might be familiar with, you know, the Huey Lewis and the News song, Jacob's Ladder, because, you know, they're cool. Okay. Crickets. Anyway, but it actually all comes from this passage in Genesis chapter 28. And your translation may say, of course, it says here, stairway, translated ladder. There were different ways that they worded it. But chances are, this is what they're pretty certain it was. It was some kind of a symbol that Jacob saw of this stairway that made its way to heaven. And there's a term for this type of building that they used in this time called a ziggurat. A ziggurat was like a temple. It was like a way that people worshipped in the pagan idolatry. That was one of the things that they used. And this ziggurat was sort of a symbol of heaven coming to earth. And so when someone like Jacob would see a ziggurat, which, you know, a lot of times, if you think of like, I think it was the Aztecs that had the big stairs that went all the way up. Like, that's kind of what a ziggurat would look like. And so when Jacob saw this, he understood that there was something going on. He wasn't like, hey, that's a cool ladder. He wasn't like, that's a neat stairway. I wonder how I could build that. It was a symbol to him that he recognized, okay, wait, this is a connection with God and earth, from heaven to earth. And interestingly enough, if you guys remember back in the beginning of Genesis, the Tower of Babel, even if you've never gone to church before, you might be familiar with the Tower of Babel. And it said that there they were trying to build a tower to make it to heaven. And that's the same kind of term. That's the same term, was this idea of a ziggurat. And the idea in the early part of Genesis there, in the Tower of Babel, was that the people were like, oh, we're going to be so good, we're going to make our way to heaven. We're going to become like God. And that's why God ended up dividing them by their languages. And so it's that same kind of symbol here that Jacob sees, this ladder, this stairway or something. Because you need to understand that. And so when he sees that the top is reaching to heaven and that there's angels descending and ascending, that there's something powerful happening here. This wasn't just a prednisone dream. There's a lot of people on prednisone. I'm wrapping up. I think today I took my last dose. And you know, it makes you do some weird dreaming. But this was actually a symbol here that Jacob was like, okay, there is something spiritual happening here. There is something powerful happening here. God is now connecting with earth. So that's important to understand for the context here, because Jacob, up until this point, doesn't really have a relationship with God. He doesn't really have a relationship with the God of his father Isaac, or the God of his grandfather Abraham, and the God of his great father Abraham, who said, Abraham, go to this land, I'm going to make this promise to you, and we'll come back to that in a little bit. So Isaac doesn't have this connection, so he's kind of having a spiritual moment here as he's having this dream, and that's important because of about what's going to happen next. If Jacob was just like, yeah, that's an interesting dream, this wouldn't matter, but he realizes there's something going on here. God is connecting with earth in this dream that he's seeing, this vision that he's seeing. So it goes from Jacob's dream to God's promise. And so this promise is huge. Because I want you to understand something here. Not that we need to, we've already reviewed it a little bit, but the series is called The Deceiver. Jacob's name means deceiver. Jacob is a jerk. Over and over again, and it doesn't end. We're not done. We've got a whole other month of Jacob being a jerk. Of him cheating people, of him lying, of him wanting what he wants. Like, he is not a good guy. And so as we get to this point here, understand that God knows everything about Jacob. God knows the whole picture of Jacob. God knows Jacob's life. God knows the story of Jacob's deception. And yet God is about to speak to Jacob in a way that has nothing to do with Jacob. So going on in the second part of verse 13, it says, "There above it, above this ladder, this stairway, stood the Lord. And he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father, Abraham, and the God of Isaac." Now look at the "I will" and "I am" statements. God says to Jacob, "I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All the peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring." And see, here in this statement, God is making the same promise that he made to Abraham and said, your family, you are going to be the line that's going to bless the entire... That just landed on me. That your line is going to be the line that is going to bless the entire world. And so he says, I'm making that promise now to you. And we talked about this in two series. It's on the slide before and afterwards. But we talked about it in the story series, where we went through the different things of this promise. But when God made this promise to Abraham, he promised him three things. He promised him a place that you're going to have a nation, a land, a physical land. And we'll talk about that in a couple more weeks. He promised him a people that your nation, that your family is going to be huge. They're going to be like the sands of the seashore. They're going to be a gigantic nation. And he promised him a promise. So a people, a place, and a promise. And he said that all of the world is going to be blessed through you. And so you're going from Abraham to Isaac. And now this promise continues to Jacob. And for a little bit of a spoiler, if you track in Matthew chapter 1, you're going to see that there's a genealogy there in Matthew chapter 1. That starts with Abraham and goes to Isaac and then to Jacob and works it all the way down until you get to this one born named Jesus. And so the promise that God made to Abraham that one of your descendants is going to bless the entire world ultimately came true in Jesus, which is really cool. We also talked about it in the end series where we looked at the end times. That's on the slide as well. And what's interesting about that is that those promises haven't completely been fulfilled yet. And I really believe that God is going to do that in the end times. And you can listen to that without getting all weird. You can listen to that. So God says, I will give you and your descendants this land. And interestingly enough, where this happens, we'll see in a moment where he renames the place Bethel. And this takes place in basically about a few miles north of where Jerusalem would be. This is taking place in the land of Israel. So at this point, the land of Israel didn't exist because Israel, as you'll see in a couple weeks, doesn't even exist yet, at least in that name. But he says, in this moment, in this spot right now where you are, Jacob, I'm going to give this land to you. And that would ultimately become the land of Israel and the capital being Jerusalem. And so all of these things are happening. And then he goes on and says, all the world peoples will be blessed through you and your offspring. Then he says, I am with you. And the word with, like I am present. I am there. And I will watch over you. And the word watch over you, it's not like, you know, what if with the watcher who just kind of stares and can't get involved. And if you don't know what that's talking about, that's fine. I'm a nerd. But it's, this word watch over means to guard and to protect. So it's not just like watching over, going, oh, don't do that. Oh, too bad. Oh, that's a bummer. But actively involved. God says, I'm going to watch over you. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to care for you. And he says, wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. Of course, he's on a journey now. He's going on a journey to get a wife. But he says, I'm going to bring you back to this land. And then he says, I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And so you've got God showing up for Jacob here and saying, look, it doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter who you are. This is what I'm going to do.
I'm going to give you this land. I am with you. I will watch over and protect you. I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I've done what I have promised you. And so, again, if you've been paying attention for the last month, if Jacob was one of our kids or one of our friends, and we saw all the things that he did, we'd be like, I'm done. I've got the list, Jacob. Naughty, 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 naughty. I'm done. Nothing but coal for you. But that's not how God works. God says, I'm doing this. It's not about you, Jacob. It's not about your failures. It's not about your past. It's not about your mistakes. It's not about your attitude. It's not about the little sins that you commit. It's not about the big sins you commit. It's not about the one-time sin you commit. It's not about the lifetime or habits of sin that you're involved in. I'm going to do this. So then it continues on. So Jacob has the dream. God makes the promise. And then Jacob worships. And this kind of ties into a little bit what we talked about last week. You know, we don't do things to earn God's love. We don't gather to worship so that God will go, oh, I'm so pleased with you. Now I love you. We gather to worship in response to God's love. We don't serve others because it's going to earn God's love. We serve others in response to how God served us through Jesus. And so it's a response. And that's exactly what happens here with Jacob. It says in verse 16, when Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid. And the word here literally means to be terrified. He was terrified and said, how awesome is this place? There is none other. This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So instantly, in reaction to this, to God showing up in a crazy, miraculous, kind of scary way, but also in a, I'm going to do this for you, Jacob. Jacob's response was worship. That was how he responded. And sometimes we miss that. We get caught up in all the stuff, and we miss like, no, I have plenty to worship about right now. How amazing God is. What he has done for me. And so he says, how awesome is this place? So that was, he did three things, by the way, in response. The first was verbally worship. Then it says, early the next morning, Jacob took the stone that he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar. And he poured oil on top of it. He called that place Bethel, which literally means, it means God, what is it? I messed up. I'm ahead of myself. House of God. Thank you. I heard you say that. It says that in your footnotes, too. Which means the house of God. And so he set up this stone. And although the city used to be called Luz, just to be clear. He set up a stone, and it was meant as a monument. And we see this happen a couple other times in the Bible, multiple other times in the Bible, where something is set up as a monument to recognize. This happened when the Israelites passed through the Jordan River on their way into the Promised Land. And how God separated the water there so that they could pass through because of the ark. And they said, take some stones from the middle of the river and set them up as a monument, as a reminder. And then Joshua even said, you know, have them say, when your kids see this monument, and they say, hey, Mom, Dad, what's that about? You tell them about how good God is. You tell them about how God brought us through. And so these are called cairns, actually, which is where Cairn University gets its name. The idea of a monument as a reminder of something. And so he set up this monument as a reminder saying, no, this was an important place because God made a promise. God made a promise to me. Even though I didn't deserve it, I'm going to worship God and say, this is the reminder stone at Bethel. And Bethel becomes a very important city as you go through the history of the nation of Israel. And then the third thing he did is that then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I'm taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's household. And by the way, this if isn't like conditional, like if God, he's saying, because God has promised, if God is willing to say that, if God is willing to be with me, if God will be with me, because God will be with me and will watch over me and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear and will bring me back to my father's household, he says, then the Lord will be my God. And this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. So we made a commitment to God. And we did a series called Offer a number of years ago where we talked about what tithe is. It was an Old Testament system for honoring. You know, you gave God a tenth your first 10%, because that was a commitment to him. And so that's what Jacob's doing here. He's saying, look, I am so amazed at what God has done for me that I'm going to respond in a commitment. And I think sometimes we do that. We say, God, I'm so amazed. Thank you for this. I commit to this. I'm going to, maybe it is a giving thing. Maybe it's a serving thing. Maybe it's a doing thing. Maybe it's a change thing. But all of that was in response to what God did for him. And so when Jacob is sleeping, God is doing something. And it looks like Jacob, well, it doesn't look like, we know that Jacob didn't do anything to earn this. And so like the song, he does to you when you're sleeping. And God knows everything that you do. God knows everything that I do. He's aware of every situation because he is what is called omniscient. He knows everything. So he sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. But that's where it stops. Because just like for Jacob here, God knows. God knew everything that Jacob did. And Jacob, you know, God didn't say, Jacob, look, I'm going to do this if. It wasn't conditional. He didn't say, Jacob, I'm going to do this if you get your act cleaned up. Jacob, why don't you go back and give, you know, trade the bowl of stew back. Give it back to your brother. Give him back the birthright. Why don't you go to your dad and tell him you lied to him and apologize and make it right? Because once you do that, Jacob, then we'll talk. And again, a lot of times we do the same thing. We're like, God, okay, I know I messed up. Once I fix this, I need to stop doing that thing. Or I've crossed the line. I can't go back now. And we try to make it up to God, and that's not how it works. God says, no, I'm doing this because I love you, because I care about you, because our failures aren't obstacles for God's grace. And what's God's grace? God's grace is the gift that he has given to us that we don't deserve. That's what grace is. Something that you earn, and this isn't on the screen, this is in the Bible, but something you earn isn't a gift. If you have to earn it, it's not a gift. It's called a wage. It's called a paycheck. A gift is something you're given with that you don't deserve. And that's what grace is. It's a gift that we don't deserve. And so our failures will not keep us from receiving God's grace. Your failure won't keep you from receiving God's grace. It's not an obstacle. It doesn't get in the way. Because God doesn't keep that list. And we'll see here in a second why. Because God's not making the list. We said there is nothing you can do to make God love you more. And there is nothing you can do to make God love you less. There is nothing you can do to make God love you less. So why is that case? Why do we know that God's not making a list? Well, here's a passage in Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10. We're going to look at verse 10, and I'm going to skip down to 17 and 18. And if you have to memorize a verse, if you've never memorized the Bible, Hebrews 10, 17 to 18 is a really good start. Hebrews 10, 17 to 18, because we're going to see here why. So in verse 10 of chapter 10, the writer of Hebrews says, "For God's will, God's desire was for us to be made holy by the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once for all time." It was God's desire for us to be clean, cleansed from our sin, to be, have our sins taken away, to be rescued from our sin. And so he sent his son Jesus to die once for all time. So Jesus died for us. He died to take your sin. And we talk about it. There's a song we've actually sung worship to called A Beautiful Exchange. This idea of God gave us his righteousness through Jesus and took our sin. Traded places. But then jumping down, continuing this thought, in verses 11 through 16, he talks about how in the Old Testament, the priests had to do work, and they had to constantly offer more sacrifices and change things, and then there'd be another sacrifice, and they'd have to keep going back and forth, and because people, their sins weren't completely forgiven, because an animal wasn't a good substitute for a human. And we're going to talk more about that next month in our Breaking News series. But then in 17, he picks up and he says, then he says, this is God. God says, I will never again remember their sins and lawless deeds. So what that means is that God will never again, through Jesus, remember your sins. He will never again remember your failures. He will never again remember the time you messed up, that mistake, that attitude, that thought, that action. Never again. Because of what Jesus has done. So he's not making a list. He doesn't have the list going up, up, because when Jesus died on the cross, and if we believe in his death on the cross for us, then it's done. Jesus said on the cross, it is finished, because it's done. And then the writer goes on and says, and when sins have been forgiven, there's no need to offer any more sacrifices. Once you've been forgiven, you don't need to, if Jesus died and took away your sin, forgiving your sin completely, you don't need to earn it back. You don't need to make up for it. You don't need to consider it like, okay, God, I messed up on that one. Boy, I better get right with God. I'm going to come to church now. So last week we were talking about earning God's love. Now we're trying to deal with the sin. Be like, oh, I'm going to show up. That'll cover up that thing I did wrong. You can't cover up something because Jesus has forgotten it. It's done on the cross. There is no list. Santa's list might have your name and naughty or nice with a checkbox. God's list just has Jesus. And it's, frankly, it's probably what have you done with Jesus? And again, we're going to come back to that next month in this breaking news series. But it's a matter of if we respond to Jesus, then it's done. There's nothing that can keep you. There's nothing that you can do to make God love you less. He is not making a list. He says, I will never again remember their sins and lawless deeds because of what Jesus Christ did on the cross once and for all. So let's talk about what that might look like. If he's not making a list, it means that even your sin, your mistake, your failure, even if it's in reaction to desperation, because sometimes we find a moment where we're like, oh man, the situation got control, like things were out of control. I was kind of a victim of what was going on, and I ended up doing this thing I knew I shouldn't have done, and I know now God's like, that's it. That was it. Sorry. And that's how we look at that. But in a situation like that, we are still forgiven through Jesus. And I'm going to have to summarize this story here. You're probably familiar with it anyway. But in Luke chapter 22, it's the story of Peter. And Peter was one of Jesus' closest followers. And just before this, we pick up here in verse 56, Jesus was arrested. And he was put on trial. And of course, the day before, a few hours before, Jesus said, hey, Peter, you're going to deny me three times. And Peter's like, no, I'm not. Because I am your best disciple. I am your best follower. I am the best. I am not going to do that. And then, in the moment, when the Roman guards and Jesus is arrested, he's being beaten, there's all this hoopla, there's people trying to take other people and arrest them, and Peter is kind of following along at a distance, and here in verse 56 it says, that someone speaks up and says, this man was one of Jesus' followers. But Peter denied it. Woman, he said, I don't even know him. Not a few hours earlier, saying, no, I'm never going to turn my back on you. But the situation kind of took control there. After a while, someone else looked at him and said, you must be one of them. No, man, I am not, Peter retorted. About an hour later, someone else insisted, this must be the one. This must be one of them because he is a Galilean too. But Peter said, man, I don't know what you are talking about. Because Peter didn't want to get arrested. Peter didn't want to get beaten up. Peter didn't want to go to trial. Peter was afraid. It was a scary time. It was a scary moment. The one that they've been following was just arrested. And right away, one, two, three, Peter denies Jesus in a few hours earlier. He said, I'm never going to do that, Jesus. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. At that moment, the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And suddenly the Lord's words flashed through Peter's mind. Before the rooster crows tomorrow evening, you will deny three times that you even know me. And just hang out on this slide for a second. And Peter left the courtyard weeping bitterly. And maybe that's where you are. You did not want to do that. You did not want to get caught up in that way. You did not want to respond to them in that situation. But the moment just kind of flew by and you were, a victim, if you want to call yourself a victim. You're like, I'm not going to do this. And then you find yourself doing that. And then you end up leaving the courtyard weeping bitterly. What have I done? What have I done? That's it. God's done with me now. I said I wouldn't do it and now I did it. I said I wouldn't go there, and now I went there. I said I wouldn't act that way, and now I've acted that way. I've made that decision, and I guess there's no going back. I'm done. Because I failed, and if I fail, then that's it. Because God can't use me, because He's got a list. And now He knows that even though I said I wasn't going to do that, and I did it, and He's like, nope, that's it. Sorry. My grace has ended. You're not going to be used by me. You're not going to heaven. Whatever it is, you want to fill in that blank. And I don't know if you're familiar with this, but there's this really cool passage in John chapter 21. So Jesus rises from the grave 3 days later, which is incredible, powerful. We'll celebrate that on Easter. And He rises from the grave and eventually kind of gathers together with His disciples. And there's this miraculous catch of fish, and Jesus is on the shore. And they all sit down and have fish for breakfast, because I guess, you know, that's what you do when you're a fisherman. It's not my cup of tea. But they're eating breakfast on the shore. And it says, after breakfast, Jesus asked Simon Peter. So Simon Peter, he had two names. He pulls him aside. And basically, you know, this is the first time they've talked since Jesus said, you're going to deny me. This is the first time they've talked since Jesus looked at him and the rooster crows three times. He says, come here, Peter. He says, do you love me more than the rest of these guys? Because remember, that's what Peter said. Oh, I'm not going to turn my back on you. They might, but I'm not. He says, do you love me more than them? Well, yes, Lord, Peter replied. You know I love you. He says, then feed my lambs. Do you love me more than these? Then Jesus repeated the question. Simon, son of John, do you love me? Yes, Lord, Peter said. You know I love you. Then take care of my sheep. Third time. Simon, son of John, do you love me? Well, Peter was hurt that Jesus asked the question a third time. And he said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Then feed my sheep. And I want you to understand something here. How many times did Jesus say that? Three. How many times did Peter deny Jesus? Three. This is very intentional. Because Jesus is going to Peter and said, look, I know you denied me, but I'm not done with you. I'm not done with you. He says, if you love me, feed my lambs. Care for my people. That's what he was saying there. Not my physical, sheep. But my flock, my people, my followers. And then he goes on and says, I tell you the truth, Peter. When you were young, you were able to do as you liked. You dressed yourselves and went wherever you wanted to go. But when you're old, you're going to stretch out your hands and others will dress you and take you where you don't want to go. Jesus said this to let him know by what kind of death he would glorify God. He said, Peter, you're going to be doing some incredible things. And then Jesus told him, you're done, buddy. You messed up three times, and that's it. And you're on my list, and I'm sorry, man. Good luck with hell. No. Then Jesus told him, follow me. Follow me. He says, Peter, I'm not done with you. It doesn't matter what you've done. And I know the situation was crazy, and we want to call ourselves victims, and we got caught up in the moment, and things went haywire, and you denied me, even though you said you wouldn't, but I am not done with you. Because your failure is not going to stop my grace. Because I'm not keeping a list. Because Jesus died to take away that sin. So you've got that kind of that heat of the moment, that thing where it happens when, oh, the situation was out of control. Well, what about on the other end? What if it's your intention? What if your desire is, you know what, I am tired of God right now. I am mad about what happened. I don't like this situation. So I am intentionally going to go against what He said. I'm going to intentionally get involved in this situation. I'm going to intentionally go there. I'm going to intentionally say that to them. I'm going to intentionally cut them off in traffic. Whatever it is. He's like, I don't care because I'm done. And he might have gotten to a situation like that where you're like, yeah, I did that. And now, man, I mean, that was intentional. It wasn't an accident. I got no excuse. God's done with me. Well, Luke 23. Again, you might be familiar with this passage. This is at the crucifixion. It says, two others, both criminals, were led out to be executed with him, meaning Jesus. And we'll come back to this passage in a moment. When they came to a place called the Skull, So Jesus and these two criminals, the trials, we actually did a series called The Trials. They were all illegal. There were six of them. All illegal, all trumped up, fake charges, so that they could arrest Jesus and kill him illegally. And so they're getting to the place called the skull. Golgotha is the Greek term for that, I believe. And there they nailed him to the cross. So let me just be clear. They are nailing Jesus to the cross. There's no one there going like, oh, how did that happen? I accidentally stuck a hammer and stuck a nail through his wrist. They knew what they are doing. They understood what was happening. There is no accidental, like, yeah, I just got caught up in the moment. My hammer started swinging and nails started flying. Like, no, this was very intentional. And they knew, these soldiers, they knew it was all fake. They knew it was a charade or a charade, if you're British. And they were nailing him to the cross in that moment. And the criminals were also crucified, one on his right and one on his left. And in that moment, they're nailing him to the cross. What does Jesus say? Jesus says, Father, forgive them. For they don't know what they're doing. They thought they knew what they were doing, but they don't realize it. And it says the soldiers gambled for his clothes by throwing dice. So even in an intentional moment, when they were intentionally nailing Jesus to the cross, Jesus said, forgive them. Forgive them. So in a moment where we're like, no, I intentionally turned my back on God. I intentionally did that thing. I didn't want to honor God. I was so mad. I was so up. Whatever. Even in that moment, Jesus is saying, Father, forgive them. Father, forgive you. Because your failure is not, it's not an obstacle. Your failure isn't going to keep God from loving you. There's nothing you can do to make God love you less. Let's go kind of back swinging the other way. What about when emotions get involved? You're angry. Oh, I'm just so angry. You respond in a way that doesn't honor Jesus. Maybe it's passion. Maybe it's lust. Maybe it's sex, whatever. There's all these emotions that tie into stuff. And we let our emotions get carried away. And we go down in a direction that we don't want to go. Or maybe we do want to go. And in those moments, we're like, ah, oh, I just didn't keep my emotion in check. Well, here in John chapter 8, you know this story probably as well. It says, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. So, there's some younger people in the room, so I'm not going to get too graphic with this, but in the act. So it's not like we heard stories. No, she got ripped out of a bed. And we don't know what got her caught up in this moment, but adultery means she's with someone else's husband. And they say, you know, the law of Moses commands us to stone such women. What do you say? And they were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. They're like, she was like, there's no question, Jesus. Look, she's probably not even clothed right now. Or very scantily clothed with maybe a sheet. Sheet, not a sheep. A sheet. If they had sheets, I don't know. Maybe straw, I don't know. But they're using this as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing Jesus. They're like, we're going to get him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, okay, look, you want an answer? You want to know what we should do about this woman that got caught up in a moment of passion? And he's not, and we'll see in a second, he's not excusing it. He's not saying, oh, it's cool, I'm cool with that one. If your emotions were out of control, it's all right. I get it. Like, that's fine. Oh, I just punched them in the face because I was so angry. Oh, well, that's cool. I just rammed my car right into them while they were walking down the road. Oh, well, you're upset. It's all right. That's not what he's doing here. But he says, let anyone of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. Because the law did require that someone would be stoned to death if they were caught in adultery. And we don't have time to get into what that means and why. But Jesus is changing the rules. Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. So they all left. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they?" He didn't say, "Woman," but like, "Woman? Young lady? Where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. He responded, "Well, you let yourself get out of control. You found yourself in the bed of another man. He's already married. And you know what? Sorry, you need to learn to keep it in check a little bit more. If you had gone to time out, you probably would have been able to handle this. But you didn't, and now you're out of control, and now you're done. So just get out of my sight, because I'm not going to use you. And by the way, your sins aren't forgiven." "No," Jesus said, "then neither do I condemn you." Now, what does he say? "Go now and leave your life of sin." He didn't say, "That's cool. Yeah, go keep sleeping around with other people's husbands." No. Fix the issue. We talked about this during the Ampersand series last spring. But he says, you know, it's not about your response to emotion. If you get caught up in an emotion, if we get caught up and there's a spot where, whether again, that's lust, whether that's anger, whether that's sadness, whether that's depression, whatever these things are that key off, and we do something that we shouldn't do, even in that moment, we are still forgiven because Jesus died on the cross for our sins. So you've got this kind of response to emotion. Well, let's swing back the other way. What if it's not just a response to an emotion? I'm losing my belt. What if it's your situation? What if this is your lifestyle? What if this is who you are now? You know, like there's this one sin, or there's this thing I did wrong, or this failure, or this mistake, but it was a one-time deal. But maybe you've got a habit. Maybe you've got an attitude. Maybe you've got a lifestyle that it's not just a thing. Oh, this is part of who I am now. And because this is who I am, God can't use me. Because this is who I am, I'm done. I've got no hope. Well, in Matthew chapter 9, we see someone that was stuck in a situation. It says that Jesus was walking along, he saw a man named Matthew sitting in his tax collector's booth. And for that, we talked about this a couple months ago, I think. But just that phrase, a man named Matthew sitting at a tax collector's booth, doesn't really mean much to us. But culturally, that meant there was a Jewish man who had sold out his own people and was collecting taxes for the Empire of Rome. That also meant that he was probably cheating people because he could get away with it, because no one could stand up to him because he had the authority of the Roman Empire behind him. And so this Matthew, who was a tax collector, like, that is the lowest of the low. Like, he sold out his people. He was taking advantage of his own family. And so there's this man who is, you know, at this point, he's committed. This is his lifestyle. He's a tax collector. He's Matthew the tax collector. And at that point, everyone around him would be like, "Oh, you're done, buddy. Oh, I can't wait for you to die. Because when you die, you are going to hell and down further somehow than that. And it's going to be even hotter because you deserve it. Because you sold us out. And we're God's people and you sold us out." But what does Jesus do? Jesus comes up to him and says, "Follow me and be my disciple." So here's a guy stuck in this lifestyle of sin, this attitude, this situation that identifies him. And Jesus is like, "No, that doesn't work for me. You follow me. You're going to be my disciple." So Matthew got up and followed him. And I'm sure there were a lot of people going, "Whoa." And actually, we'll see in a second, there were people that went, "Whoa." It says later, Matthew invited Jesus and his disciples to his home as dinner guests, along with many other tax collectors. So now he's got a group of people that sold out the Jewish people, and other disreputable sinners. So it's a group of, like, messed up people, and they're called sinners. So that's like their identity. And when the Pharisees saw this, they asked the disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with such scum?" That's how they were seen. These people were caught in a lifestyle and an attitude and a habit and a pattern of sin. So they weren't even considered, like, normal. They were just scum. When Jesus heard this, he said, "Healthy people don't need a doctor. Sick people do." And he goes on and says, "I'm here for the sick." And maybe that's you. Maybe you're in a habit or a lifestyle or a pattern of something that, frankly, you just identify yourself with that now. And Jesus says, follow me. He says, I'm not done with you. That attitude, that habit, that pattern, that's not going to stop me. I love you. I'm here to help you. Because sick people need the doctor. And finally, you know, we talk about desperation. Next slide. You're in a moment, the situation takes over, you can't control it. Maybe it's intentional. You know what, I'm going up against God. I don't care. Maybe it's an emotional thing that took control and you just gave in to something. And maybe it's just how you identify yourself. But I want to throw this last one in here. And we're going to, again, next month we're doing a series called Breaking News. And we're going to talk about the good news of Jesus. But this idea of sometimes we're like, well, I did this thing and now I need to earn God's love back. I need to make up for it. I need so that God, I can't use me until I fix this. And I just want you to know that that's not how God works. Even when it's too late for you to fix it, God still offers forgiveness. And there's this passage here. We're in Luke chapter 23. We're going to be there again here. In verse 39, a little bit later than we were just reading when they were nailing him to the cross, it says, one of the criminals hanging beside Jesus scoffed. So you're the Messiah, are you? Prove it by saving yourself. And us too, while you're at it. So they're making fun of him. He's mocking Jesus, this one criminal. But the other criminal protested and said, don't you fear God even when you have been sentenced to die? It's like, we're all here on the cross. We're all about to die. The worst form of execution ever devised by man. We deserve to die for our crimes. But this man hasn't done anything wrong. So he recognizes there's something powerful about Jesus. And so this thief, this criminal, is hanging on a cross next to Jesus. And he has the guts to say, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus, take me into heaven with you. And now, for us, we would go, sorry, buddy, you're about to die. There is nothing you can do to fix this. You can't be good again. And Jesus would be like, sorry, guy. You know what? If you're on the ground, you know, not on the cross yet, I'd be like, hey, why don't you go be nice to that lady across the street? And why don't you go over and you know, serve in the church nursery? And why don't you go, you know, and then we can talk about making up for it. But he was on the cross. There was literally nothing he could do except die. That's the next step. And Jesus replies to him and said, I assure you, I promise you, I guarantee, today you will be with me in paradise. Why? Not because of anything he could have done to earn God's love, not because of anything he did. Obviously, he was on the cross being crucified as a criminal, so he did some things that were wrong. No chance to make up for it. And Jesus said, you're going to be with me in paradise. Why? Because of his faith in Jesus. He's not making a list. Even if you feel like it's a spot where it's too late, oh, I can't make up for it. Jesus is like, it doesn't even matter. Desperation, nope, doesn't stop me. My grace is still good through my death on the cross. His grace is still good. Your intentions, if you did on purpose, hey, that's all right, it doesn't stop me. Your emotion, got control, that's okay. Because that's not enough for me to not be able to show you my love. Your situation, you find yourself, that's how you identify, it's your lifestyle. Nope, not a problem. Or even if it's too late to make it right, it's okay because that's not how God works. Because Hebrews 10 says, for God's will was for us to be made holy by the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once for all time. Then he says, I will never again remember their sins and lawless deeds. And when sins have been forgiven, there is no need to offer any more sacrifices. Because our failures, two slides, aren't obstacles for God's grace. Your failures aren't obstacles. There is nothing you can do to make God love you more. We talked about that last week. And there's nothing you can do to make God love you less. There is no sin, act, failure, lifestyle, attitude, anything that you can, will, or have done that will keep Jesus from offering grace to you. It's simply, just like the thief on the cross, simply through belief in what He has done for us. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for Jacob and the promise that you made to him that wasn't contingent or dependent on him making it right. It wasn't a matter of how good or bad he was in the past, and frankly, he was pretty bad. But you stepped in and said, I will, I will, I will, I will. And God, similarly, it's true for us. Through Jesus, simply through believing in his death on the cross, you have forgiven us of all of our past. You've forgiven us of our present and our future if we simply believe in you. And so I pray that you would help us change our attitude, help us to realize that there is nothing we can do to make you love us less. That there's nothing that will change your love for us, that you're not making a list and checking it twice. Because you took all of those sins in your body when you died on the cross for us. Help us to accept that and to receive that. And maybe that's for the first time for someone that has never made the decision to believe in Jesus and have their sins forgiven. God, I pray that they wouldn't leave without being challenged by that thought. And maybe it's someone that has made that decision, and yet we keep kind of getting caught up in how we need to earn your love back. Help us to put that aside too and believe that your death was final, that it is finished on the cross. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.